KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thanks for tuning in during KCRW's Season of Giving Back. We're so grateful that you're here with us. If you're grateful for us, too, show it with a year-end donation. Go to kcrw.com/give. From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I don't think that the producing and finding financing for your movies means that you are a shrewd businessman. It means that you want to have control over the process of what you do, which I think is the most important way of owning and really making sure that you are expressing yourself.
Call Me By Your Name director Luca Guadagnino knows that some people might be reluctant to watch his latest film, the cannibal romance Bones and All. He explains what drew him to the project, and the self-proclaimed workaholic talks about his other recent film, the high-fashion documentary Salvatore, Shoemaker of Dreams. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, as you well know, Netflix paid an eye-watering $465 million, almost half $1 billion, for two sequels to Knives Out, which was initially a regular theatrical movie that played until it exhausted its window, made a lot of money, but Netflix jumped in there and they bought it. And I guess to make the deal, they agreed that with Rian Johnson, the director, and his producer, that they would do something they'd never done before, which is to run it for a week in 600 theaters, the first time they've done a deal with the big theater chains, AMC and Regal, and then they would pull it. A month will pass, and on December 23rd, this thing will be on Netflix. Now, many people, some of whom work at Netflix, were really hoping that Netflix would get a taste of that cash, because we don't have exact numbers, but we know it did very well during its week on only 600 screens, which is small for a broad release. They were hoping Netflix would get on the crack pipe of that cash coming through the door, but Netflix did not. Netflix did not extend it, did not try to extend it as far as we know, kind of boasted that they don't want to extend it.
Exactly. And I never thought they would. I mean, this was a stunt that they did for two reasons. One, to appease the filmmaker who really wanted this. And two, to kind of see if this kind of a high profile release for a week will help or hurt the film when it debuts on streaming. And I think the jury's out on that. I happen to believe that these kinds of theatrical releases help when it debuts on streaming because it creates an event and, you know, it creates more hoopla around the movie. But we'll see how it does when it lands there. Reed Hastings was very specific. He said at a conference this past week, "We're not in the business of building up theatrical. We are in the business of breaking through the noise." And they believe that this kind of a stunt helped that and that they can do it on streaming.
Yeah, of course, they don't report the box office, so we think it very well. They don't report meaningful streaming numbers that we can make sense of. Sometimes they say, this is huge, but we don't really know exactly. And I think that people have just been frustrated in the community. You know, other companies that are relied on the old model, like every major studio, basically, they want Netflix to admit that they wanted to reinvent the wheel in Hollywood and they don't know what they're doing. And there's ever so much more money to be made. And they wanted it to go differently. And I just think even Rian Johnson, if he's honest, and his producer feel they would have much rather just had it be like so compelling that Netflix would say, yes, we will do more theatrical, as they have done. You know, they weren't going to do advertising and now they're launching an ad tier. So they have inched toward a different thing. But in this case, no.
Well, Rian Johnson got paid almost $500 million for two movies. So he sort of forfeits the right to complain about what Netflix wants to do with those movies.
Yeah, he doesn't get to keep that. He has to use some of it to make the movie. But
that's true. But he made a lot of money on this, as did Daniel Craig. Nobody should feel bad for them. However, you know, this is a guy who is a big champion for the theatrical experience. And I think the takeaway from this one-week experiment is that nobody was sort of happy with it. And the theater owners were very grateful for the movie. They, you know, said they would put it in 600 theaters. But what they saw is that the per screen average for the movie was very high. It could have done a lot more and would have likely played through the holidays. So they're not excited. I think a lot of talent that saw what was going on said, well, wait a second, I'm making a movie for Netflix. Where's my 1 week in 600 theaters? They're not doing this for me. And I think when you look at the overall streaming component, Netflix wasn't that happy doing this. They did say it was a stunt, but they firmly believe that the Netflix movie should play on Netflix. So it's sort of like there's no happy campers with this situation.
Yes. And I just will note quickly that, you know, this has been a lean year. There haven't been enough movies to really go into theaters. It's been very, very short due to the pandemic. And I'm sure the theater owners were disappointed, hoping that Netflix would say, you know what, we're going to go longer.
For the theater owners, this is like Netflix showing them a big, juicy cheeseburger, letting them take a bite and then yanking it back.
Just yanking it right back. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. Luca Guadagnino keeps so busy producing and directing that lately his projects have tended to stack up on top of each other. Guadagnino has already released two films in theaters this fall, Salvatore, Shoemaker of Dreams, and Bones and All. He's currently in post-production on another picture set to premiere next summer. Guadagnino's first release of the year was the Sony Pictures Classics documentary, Salvatore, Shoemaker of Dreams, an ode to famed Italian designer Salvatore Ferragamo. The film combines interviews, including one with Martin Scorsese, while Guadagnino's frequent collaborator, Michael Stuhlbarg, is the voice of the Italian footwear designer.
If I went to America, I could learn their tricks. I began to dream.
In a sense, it must have been an act of freedom, a chance to create yourself.
And that's when my story began.
We talked to Guadagnino on the opening day of Bones and All. The director was on a marathon global press tour to promote the film. I hear you're tired, though. You've been flying and running and doing this and that.
Well, I've been not home for 3 months. I've been taking planes every week, and I have broken a foot a month ago.
Oh.
And I just recovered. And in the last 3 weeks, I've been in Europe, in Brazil, in Argentina, in America. So it's a bit too much. But I mean, it's good to talk about the movie, and I'm happy to be supporting my movie. So it's just that I am, like, between jet lag and travels, it's just a lot.
It sounds like it. It sounds rather exhausting.
Yes.
I actually am trying to keep your schedule, not your actual schedule, but just your commitments in terms of film straight in my head. And there are so many, I feel slightly dizzy. I don't know how you, are you a workaholic, Luca?
I don't know. I think I am. Yeah.
Yeah.
I am a workaholic. I like to work, and I like to work a lot, and I like to have a sort of like arrow that goes from left to right, but also from top to bottom. So I work in every direction, I would say.
So I think you have two films to promote right now. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I have the documentary on Salvatore Ferragamo that came out at the beginning of the month that I presented in Venice 2 years ago, and now finally it got released in America. And then I have Bones and All that opens today in LA and New York.
Let's talk about Ferragamo just for a minute. I don't know what drew you to that and whether there was involvement by the company at all in the making of the film.
Not the company, the family. You know, like a while ago, I worked for Ferragamo, the company. I directed a short film with the wonderful Caia Scodelario. And I bumped into the book that Mr. Ferragamo wrote back in the 60s, The Shoemaker of Dream. And I discovered this amazing and wonderful person and genius in a way. And so I had a relationship with one of the heirs of the family, Diego di San Giuliano, who is the son of Fiamma Ferragamo, the first daughter of Salvatore. And I said to Diego, wow, Diego, it's just a so fascinating story, the story of your grandfather. Why don't you ever thought about doing something about it? Like, what about a documentary? And one thing led to another, and eventually I ended up making this film.
And you sold it to Sony Pictures Classics. I read a quote, you were talking about a Billy Wilder quote, show business is show business because without business, it would be show. And from his perspective, this was the great of sin. This was, you were talking about his quote, and you said you weren't sure you agreed. So to what degree do you involve yourself with the business aspect on your films?
100%. Like, I am producer and director of all my movies since now 14 years. So I have knowledge and involvement in all the phases of every one of my films, starting from script development to financing and cash flowing and producing and directing, of course.
What part of the Billy Wilder quote do you not agree with?
Well, I think the position of Billy Wilder was a bit different. I think he meant that films had to make business as films, which means that you have to think about the actual films as a product, not only as art. You know, that I think that was a sort of like, probably from his point of view, a differentiation from the way in which Europe cinema of auteur thought of itself as just cinema of art. So it's a bit different. You know, like, I don't think that the producing and finding financing for your movies means that you are a shrewd businessman. It means that you want to have control over the process of what you do, which I think is the most important way of owning and really making sure that you are expressing yourself at the full of your way of expressing yourself. But that doesn't mean that eventually the material that you end up making, the movies you end up making, have to be per se products or content that can make business out of it, not just entertainment or art. That's why I don't completely agree with him, because otherwise we should say that something like Persona by Ingmar Bergman should not have been done, or Memoria by Api Chaptong Verasatekul should not have been done, because those clearly are two examples of two films that are sophisticated and very kind of like obscure way of presenting an audiovisual to an audience. But I believe that both movies deserve to exist as cinema along with the more commercial fare, because it's not just that you have to sell tickets, it's also how you can change the mind of even one audience member.
Yes, but it's something of a luxury, I think, to be able to make a film without worrying about the commercial fate of that film, right?
Well, you know, like, that's a very interesting topic, because it depends on the scale. Clearly, if you make like a Memoria that costs $60 million, then that's a luxury. But if you make a Memoria that costs $2 million or $4 million, and then you make this movie seen a lot around the world and in time, and maybe the movie makes its money back and a little bit of a profit, probably is more interesting as a process than a movie that costs 60, that needs another 60 to be distributed, eventually makes maybe 40, and it's not very interesting and is forgettable, and people forget about it in like 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Or 6 weeks even. Who knows?
Or 6 weeks, or the windows that goes to straight to streaming.
Right. It's a whole other thing. So when you say that you involve yourself in the business of your films because you want control, and you make a movie like the Ferragamo movie with the family involved, do you have to yield some control to them, or do you want to yield some control to them? How did that work?
They had no control over my movie. I did the movie I wanted, the way I wanted. I thought that Ferragamo was such an inspiring person that there was something about him, about his kind of relentless, maverick sense of creation and invention and reinvention of self that was kind of a fairy tale. So I love the idea to cross over a story of self-realization with the history of Hollywood and with the history of fashion. There was something about it, about this kind of fairy tale that was very touching to me. So we weren't trying to put Mr. Ferragamo under a light that could have turned off the family, because there was no need for us to do that. We were trying to make literally a movie about someone who called himself the shoemaker of dreams. So there was the humbleness of being a shoemaker, and there was the visionary aspect of thinking of life as a dreamscape. I thought that was quite touching, but the actual process of making the movie and everything else was in my hands, and I didn't have to negotiate any space or any control with the family at all.
Coming up after the break, as you might expect, Luca Guadagnino confirms that Timothée Chalamet was the deciding factor in choosing to make Bones and All. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Luca Guadagnino's films often involve stories that bind tension and intimacy, including the 2017 summer romance, Call Me By Your Name. Guadagnino does it again in his audacious offering, Bones and All, a tender yet gruesome love story about people, people who eat people. In Bones and All, troubled teenager Marin, played by Taylor Russell, is at the mercy of a compulsion to eat human flesh. A misfit for obvious reasons, she embarks on a road trip to find her long-lost mother. On this journey, she has her first encounters with others like her. Eventually, she meets Lee, played by Timothée Chalamet, who joins her in her search. Early in the movie, Marin is spotted by a strange man named Sully, played by Mark Rylance. He offers to cook her dinner, and while expertly deboning a whole chicken, shares insights on their condition.
Are there lots of us?
Not lots, but more, more than you think. You've met a few, sure, that you know of. You never had anyone take an interest in you? A double take?
The idea of making Bones and All came from screenwriter David Kujanic, who previously worked with Guadagnino on A Bigger Splash and Suspiria. He brought you the idea, he told you about Bones and All, is that correct?
I didn't remember well, and now I know how it went because Dave reminded me. I think Dave was approached by one of our producers back like a few years ago, Teresa Park. She gave him the book by Camille DeAngelis. I think he must have been attracted by the book, and he sent me the book and he asked me if I was interested in that. But at the time I was working on my show, We Are We Are. So I really didn't put a lot of attention there. Actually, I almost not even put any attention there. And then I kept talking to David because in the meantime, we are friends and we were working on other stuff. And he might have referred to these Eaters, this cannibal film that he was working on with the director Antonio Campos. Up until, like, it must have been 2 years later, and this was the end of 2020, he called me saying that Antonio was not making the movie anymore, and if I was interested in reading the script, at which I replied that I wasn't because, as you say, Kim, I'm very busy and I have many projects lined up. So I didn't want to put another one on top of the others and let maybe Dave wait for me and drag him because I don't like to do that. But he insisted, and I have a sort of mandate to myself. Like if someone asks me more than once a thing, and more than two actually, I eventually always say, okay.
I read that you said that, and that made me nervous for you. I mean, people are going to pester you now and keep asking when they want something from you.
That's why I try not to pick up phone calls that I don't want to pick up.
Okay.
But anyway, I said yes also because, you know, he's my dear friend. He's a great writer. And I was curious about how he put together this story. What was the script looking like? And I read the script and I loved it. And I surrendered to the script, to the characters, and to the idea of working with Timothy. And that's how I ended up saying to David, okay, I will put what I'm planning to making now on a side in order to do this one. Timothy is somebody that once I started reading the script, I had immediately saw him. I thought like, oh my God, this is somebody who I can see Timothy could make a portrait of beautifully. The more I was reading the script, the more I was reinforcing this idea. And I remember I said to David, once I finished the script, I said, the script is just wonderful. And I am happy to do it if Timothy does it. So I called Timmy. He was in Italy. I gave him the script and we met in Rome. And we started having these wonderful conversations about the movie, about the concept behind the movie, about the idea of this America, of disenfranchisement. And the script presented Lee as more of a kind of commanding figure, someone who was kind of there to protect Marin. And Timmy had this wonderful intuition in which he said, hey, I think he should be someone as broken and as lost as Marin, if not more than Marin.
Yes.
Which triggered a lot of thoughts and, and direction that changed. So I said, why don't we all talk, me, you, and David? Why we don't start like a little writer room? And we all talked to David about these ideas. And that led us to a beautiful conversation that lasted for a few weeks. And the last draft, which was the draft that we eventually shot, happened.
I would have to think that his involvement was really important. Obviously, you said to you as an artist wanting to do the film, but also to the financing of the film.
Well, I was in search for something to do with Timothy for a long time. I am in awe of him. I think he's such a great artist, and it's someone I get a lot of inspiration from. At the same time, he is probably the most important actor of his generation. And that comes with a lot of responsibilities in a way, because it means that the attention he commands from people makes him someone who could choose to do things that can mean a lot or can be meaning more for himself only. You know, there are actors who chooses the characters, and there are actors who chooses the film and the director. And he is the latter. He, with his presence, made possible to make this movie, which might have been a bit more difficult to make. Certainly for me, as you said, that was a lot of inspiration coming from that and a lot of artistic elevation to me. I was in a good position as an artist, let's say, in big brackets, and as a producer. So I had a star to make the movie with, and I had a great actor to make the movie with at the same time.
Yes, and the particular subject matter, which I'm sure you know, many people just have a very reflexive response to the idea. I think it takes a lot of guts on Timothy's part to do it.
Yeah, and that's what I love about him.
And without him, I don't know that it could, I mean, I guess it could be done. I don't know what the budget of the movie is, and maybe you don't want to tell me, but do you think that you were able to do it at a certain number that you wouldn't have gotten if you without a star of his magnitude?
Maybe. The movie cost around $20 million. I think maybe. It is possible that a movie with another actor would have cost a little bit less, but that's not the point. For me, it's not about the budget. What it's about is that this movie can communicate through Timothy and in a way overcome the reflex in some people and make people accept to enter in this world to discover the tenderness of the story, the actual heartbreaking aspect of the film, not the sensationalism and the shock value, which is something that we weren't interested in at all.
Yeah, I think that it's hard for people to grasp who haven't seen it that it is a tender film. I feel like I'm on your publicity payroll because I've explained this to so many people. It's really a tender film, even though, you know, that's something that I know you would have to overcome in this, you know, I don't know to what degree you want to be in the awards race, but, you know, to be in it, you have to overcome, especially with some members of the Academy who are not exactly the ideal demographic, let's say.
I don't know if I want to be in the award or contention. It's not of me to be saying that. I think whether you become part of it or not, you have to accept it and then you have to support it. Of course, to be recognized in your work, it's something extraordinary and beautiful. And hopefully people will overcome their reflexes and they will understand the good intentions of this fable and agree that we're not really looking for shock value. We are looking for a visceral, if dark, but yet super affecting love story.
Yes. So I understand you got the script in September of...
The end of September of 2020.
And you were greenlit very quickly, I think.
Yeah, in October. Kim, I have no patience for development. I just have no patience. I don't care. That's a complete different job that I don't want to be part of.
Right. So you're like, this is my script.
Yeah, that's the script. That's the cast. That's the budget. Do you want to do it? Yes or no?
So who stepped in with the financing? Because I think you were acquired by MGM, right?
The movie was fully financed through Italy. This movie has been put together in like a week. And I knew few people that I knew they would have been very interested in this. And I made a few phone calls. Other people made more phone calls. And in a week, we collected the amount of money needed to make the movie.
Wow. I mean, you are who you are, and Timothy is who he is, but still, I'm impressed, I'll say. So then you were acquired, it was Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi running MGM at the time, right? When you were acquired?
Yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, they understood the movie and they went, yeah, let's go for it, which was amazing. And then eventually the movie became a distribution between MGM in America and Warner's in the rest of the world and Vision in Italy. So it's been just a wonderful journey with these three wonderful companies.
Well, you go to bed with, you know, MGM with DeLuca and Abdi and you wake up with Amazon. How's that had any impact on the distribution of the movie?
No. I mean, of course, I adore Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi, and now I wish them the best of luck and the great journey at Warner's, and I look forward to work with them there. But I have to be honest, like I did Suspiria with Amazon. So I had many friends at Amazon and it was wonderful to find them back. And I, you know, like I when I was a kid, I was reading basically just books about Hollywood and books about cinema. So I kind of knew that nothing is fixed in time here in this community. And so you have to be adapting yourself. But the good news is that Amazon was wonderful. Jen Salke was amazing. In college, we were working on another movie with MGM, with Challengers, when Mike and Pam left the company and went on running production at Warner Brothers Discovery. But, you know, my friends at Amazon were supportive and wonderful immediately.
Was the plan already more or less in place? The distribution plan? I mean, how many theaters and how it rolls out, that sort of thing?
No, we started to talk about it, you know, how to get this movie out in the world. And I was a bit more old-fashioned. So I thought, like, why don't we do a platform release, like a sort of like slow rollout. Mm-hmm. And but I kind of forget that we had this little thing called COVID. And I've been explained how COVID changed a lot of habits. So that's why now this movie opens in LA and New York, 5 theaters overall. But then we go wide the Thanksgiving weekend.
And then eventually to streaming. I have to imagine that you definitely want people to see this movie on a big screen. It's your first movie set in this country, and it's kind of a road trip movie.
Yeah, I mean, I do movies for the big screen, and I don't want it to sound pompous, but I really work for the big screen. That's how I grow up as a filmmaker. But I think every movies end up being movies for the streamers or for home consumption. So one way or another, you start in the big screen and you end up in the small screen. And then hopefully, if the movies stand the proof of time, they go back to the big screen in Cinematheques. Mm. Full circle.
Right. So let me turn back to you and your busy filmmaking career. I think the next film is Challengers, right? Which is a comedy.
Yeah. it's a sexy comedy set in the world of tennis.
With Zendaya and...
It's Mike Feist, the
from
divine
West Side Story.
Of West Side Story, Josh O'Connor, and the magnificent and, willful Zendaya.
Yes. So that's a palate cleanser, so to speak, after this drama that you just are putting into the world about tormented flesh eaters.
I think that watching Bones and All, I want people to cry and be heartbroken. But I think that watching Challengers, my goal is to have people on the edge of their seats and laughing and eventually crying as well.
Okay, that sounds like something people want to see. Luca Guadagnino, who always delivers, produced and directed Salvatore.
Who thinks that he always delivers.
Who thinks that he always delivers. Produced and directed Salvatore, Shoemaker of Dreams, and Bones and All. Both films are in theaters. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kim. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz, PJ Shahamit, and Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. With the end of the year comes the time for giving, and not just to your family and friends, but to the causes you care about. With KCRW's food bank partnerships, you can support public radio and fight food insecurity at the same time. What better time than the holiday season to fight food insecurity in Los Angeles or Santa Barbara County? Do it right now by supporting KCRW. We'll be doubling the meals donated to our food bank partners during the season of giving back. Here in LA County, the data show that 1 in 4 people experiences food insecurity, but you can make a difference. Give a fundamental need to a neighbor with KCRW's food bank program. We're making it a priority this holiday season. Choose the food bank option and we'll double the meals donated during our season of giving back. Go to kcrw.com/give and choose the food bank option in place of a thank you gift. Don't need another mug or t-shirt? Give to the food bank instead, and we'll match your meals. It's been a tough year for so many of our neighbors, but this is one way to make an impact this holiday. Do it today at kcrw.com/give.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.